From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
There's a version of the movie that doesn't have any apes in it. It's got Andy Serkis and the other performers. And that movie has to work before you start spending the tens of millions of dollars. I mean, this frame by frame, these effects are so incredibly expensive, it's ridiculous.
Director Matt Reeves knew his new film, War for the Planet of the Apes, had to work even without any help from computer-generated effects. He shot the whole film first with his actors in special motion capture suits, and he finds it so compelling he'd like to release that version as a DVD extra. Reeves tells us about making the transition from directing smaller films to big franchise movies and offers some early thoughts on his next project, The Batman. But first on the news banter, Emmy nominations and the Trump effect? Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my co-banterer, Michael Schneider of IndieWire and Variety. Hello, Mike.
Hello, Kim.
So let's start with Emmy nominations. That was some of the big TV news of last week. HBO continues to dominate with how many nominations, Mike? This is the kind of thing you keep in your head.
Yeah, 111, which is pretty remarkable when you realize that Game of Thrones wasn't even eligible this year, and they managed to increase their numbers. So
yes.
it's a big year for that network.
Westworld is the big one, 22 nominations. Of course, that is HBO's sci-fi epic set in a world where some people are real and some people are not people. Go take a little listen to that.
Do you know where you are?
I'm in a dream.
You're in my dream. I designed every part of this place. It's not a theme park, but an entire world.
And, you know, this has been also a good year for broadcast, tying Westworld with 22 nominations is Saturday Night Live. And I think we can assume that the Trump administration had something to do with that. Melissa McCarthy was nominated as a guest for her performance as Sean Spicer, her unforgettable performances as Sean Spicer. Alec Baldwin, of course, was nominated. And you know for what? Let's just take a listen.
Hello, thank you for coming. I'd like to start by answering the question that's on everyone's mind. Yes, this is real life. This is really happening.
So with those Saturday Night Live nominations, Mike, NBC has done a lot for broadcast television, you know, more nominations than in years.
Yeah, kind of single-handedly propping up broadcast because overall broadcast is still down. The other networks saw some big declines, but NBC was up, SNL helped. But of course, This Is Us, the great savior of broadcast TV now, earned several nominations, including Outstanding Drama, the first broadcast drama actually to get a nomination since 2011. A broadcast show hasn't won the drama category since 2006, so this is a big deal for that show. There aren't many broadcast shows nominated anymore, and you know, you can count on one hand, honestly, how many are these days. But the big story is, of course, streaming.
Yes, Netflix weighed in just on the heels, sort of HBO, 91 nominations. Of course, Stranger Things, Big, and The Crown.
Yeah, I mean, they managed to spread things around. I mean, they've got Master of None, they got The Crown, like you mentioned, they've got all sorts of specials. In some ways, let's be honest, Netflix and HBO are acting more like broadcast networks these days. They have such a wide range of programming, comedy, drama, limited run, movies, kids shows. They managed to spread the wealth, and they're justly rewarded with so many nominations.
Yeah, Hulu, which of course has been trying to break out for a long time now, did this year with Handmaid's Tale. I would say that the number of nominations for that would reflect, again, maybe an influence of the environment politically.
I would say so. I mean, it definitely was a coming out party for Hulu, probably their best reviewed show yet. But, a lot of people were making a joke. Maybe the show should have been nominated in the documentary category.
Well, of course, we have the usual list of snubs and oversights. Let me start with things that were not snubbed that maybe should have been. Shows like Modern Family and House of Cards, you know, worthy shows that have had really stellar seasons in the past. But I think certainly our critics feel like enough already.
Yeah, there are certain shows that you sort of feel like they've been awarded enough and it's time to move on. The one exception to that rule probably is Julia Louis-Dreyfus, who is on track to break some records by winning her sixth consecutive Emmy for playing Selena Meyer on Veep. That one, honestly, keep giving her all the Emmys because that's such an amazing show and amazing performance. But Emmy still traditionally likes to hold on, cling on to shows long after their expiration date.
Yeah, we've had this conversation before. I know our critic Dan Feinberg Eisenberg went particularly crazy that Barb from Stranger Things got a nomination. I mean, we must note that Barb was not actually, like, moving at all for much of her performance. I mean, it's fun, but, yeah, it doesn't elevate the Emmys when stuff like that happens, I think.
Yeah. You know, there's always sort of the gimmicky awards, I suppose. I can't get too mad. It's in the guest actor category, and that's always been a weird category anyway, because, you know, some people are only on for split seconds and they're nominated. Others are basically almost series regulars and they're nominated. So why not? Bring in Barb, you know.
And I'm going to return to the theme of the Trump influence and note that Stephen Colbert nominated for The Late Show and Jimmy Fallon overlooked. Again, it feels like the politics of the day are making themselves felt.
Right, absolutely. I mean, this year, of course, everyone was talking about Full Frontal with Samantha Bee, which finally got a nomination. Late Show, like you mentioned. Real Time with Bill Maher, still nominated despite the controversy over his use of the N-word. And I think that's partly, again, because most of the shows nominated this year in that category dived deep into politics and were rewarded with nominations.
Speaking of words that people can't say generally on TV, I'm going to quickly just bring up the Walking Dead lawsuit. You know, AMC fired the creator of the series, Frank Darabont. There's a very nasty lawsuit going on. His agents and he are suing over money that he says he is owed. A stream of emails has been released. I'm going to read just one of them. These reflect his incredible frustration on the show. I think AMC's position is, this proves why he should be fired. I don't know whether it proves why he should be fired or why we should feel bad for him, but I'm going to read just one little outtake from these emails that came out. And forgive me for the language. He says in a June 2011 email to one of the executive producers and some others, "F*** you all for giving me chest pains because of the staggering incompetence, blindness to the important beats, and the beyond arrogant lack of regard for what is being written being exhibited on set every day. I deserve better than a heart attack because people are too stupid to read a script and understand the words." And he goes on from there, Mike.
Yeah, well, the one thing you can say is he is equal opportunity when it comes to these F-bomb emails. He hits executives, producers, even camera operators. So, you know, this was a tough job to give him a little bit of a slack. I don't want to give him a lot because these are pretty abusive emails, but adapting this comic book was not an easy task, and the fact that he pulled it off is nothing short of pretty miraculous, and the fact that it went on to become one of the biggest shows in the history of television, and definitely the biggest show in the history of cable television, is a big deal. But yeah, nonetheless, these are pretty stunning emails.
Yeah, they did try to slash his budget after he got the show off to a great start, but, you know, Hollywood is tough sometimes on both sides. Thank you, Mike.
Thanks, Kim.
That's Michael Schneider of IndieWire and Variety. War for the Planet of the Apes, the third film in Fox's recent reboot of the Apes franchise, tells the story of Caesar and his struggle to save his clan from murderous humans. Played by a digitally altered Andy Serkis, Caesar tries to keep the peace, but a vicious military commander, played with relish by Woody Harrelson, isn't having it.
You're stronger than we are,
but you're taking this all much too personally.
So emotional!
Caesar tries to move his clan to what he hopes will be safer ground. Along the way, he encounters another ape, played by Steve Zahn, who reveals that, like Caesar, he can speak, a skill he picked up while humans held him captive.
Are there more like you? More apes from zoo?
Dead. All dead. Long time.
Human gets sick. Ape gets smart. Then human kill ape. But not me. I run.
The director of War for the Planet of the Apes is our guest today, Matt Reeves. He has been at the helm of the second and third movies in the most recent Fox reboot of the Apes franchise. The first film in the trilogy, Rise of the Planet of the Apes, was directed by Rupert Wyatt, who signed on to do the next film but then dropped out, leaving his successor, Reeves, operating under tight time constraints. Reeves got his start as a screenwriter and, unlikely as it now seems, co-created the 1998 TV series Felicity with his longtime friend J.J. Abrams. He went on to direct the modestly budgeted horror films Cloverfield and Let Me In. Since then, he's taken on a couple of huge studio features, making a transition that has stymied some others. Learning to do this. I'm wondering, because what we've seen is this phenomenon of a young director makes a movie that works, maybe a small one, and all of a sudden he's thrust into that chair. It's usually
absolutely.
He. It's just occurred to me, is there a failure to train, or did you have a route to success for you that somehow trained you?
So I did Cloverfield, and that created some interest in me doing some studio stuff, because that wasn't really a studio film. That was basically an independent film that was released by a studio, because really it was Bad Robot was the studio.
J.J. Abrams' company, and a smallish budget.
Yeah, it was a small movie. That was the first time I'd ever done visual effects, but it was a different sort of thing, a different beast. And I, after that, started getting offers from studios, and then I did another small film, which was Let Me In. Interestingly, because it wasn't a success, but it was well-received, that one put me on even more lists. So I was meeting with all of these different studios, and they were offering me lots of franchise stuff, of course, because that's what studios make. And I had turned it all down because I'd never been offered a franchise that I could connect to. It may look from the outside like, oh, you're doing Planet of the Apes. How personal can that be? But I actually had a love of this franchise.
You had an inner ape.
Yeah, I had my inner ape, and I saw there were things in it that Andy in Rise reminded me of my son, and this whole idea of us looking at our own nature and all the stuff that was very, you know, my son was one and just learning how to speak. There were all these things I thought, you know, this is going to be a rare opportunity. And so I didn't say no. And I went in and I was ready to say no. And I think being rooted in what you will and won't do, you know, when I came in, they offered me the movie and I said, okay, so what's the story? And they didn't have a story. They had an outline. I read
the
outline.
This is the first film.
This was the first film. Yeah, this was Dawn. I met with Dylan Clark like about a year ago or longer, and we connected over Planet of the Apes.
This is the executive at Peter Chernin's Chernin
Entertainment.
Yes,
he's one of the producers with Peter, yeah. And he and I connected over Planet of the Apes. And so when
original Planet of the Apes?
The original Planet of the Apes. And when the movie fell apart, when Rupert decided he didn't want to do it, he thought of me because we had this, and he had wanted me to be on another, I actually didn't meet with him at Planet of the Apes originally, it was about another franchise. So I had said no to him, actually. And I was saying no again based on this outline, and actually he said, no, wait a minute. You shouldn't say no yet. You should tell me and tell the studio the story that you would tell. And I was like, well, why would I do that? That's going to be a Faustian bargain. I'm going to go in. You're going to give me like 16% of what I want, and then we're going to have to do 20% of this, and then I'm going to need to save the thing from the outline where they have the big showdown at Candlestick Park, you know, some horrible monster of a movie, which is what I understood studio blockbuster filmmaking to be. And he said, no. So I spent a week figuring out what I would do, and amazingly, they said yes. And I said, wait a minute, you're saying yes, so you'll let me make this movie? And they said yes. And I said, so what's the catch? And they said, the catch is you have to make it on this timeline, which was really fast. I thought about it, and I thought, wow, if they're really going to let me make this movie, which I'm really excited about, my story, then I have to take it. Now, obviously, that kind of thing doesn't always work. There are plenty of times when somebody said, you told me I could make this movie, and they say, yeah, well, no, we're not going to make that movie,
yeah.
And then they railroad over you.
Why don't you sit in a chair, and we'll make a movie, and you can pretend that you made the movie.
Which is not to say that I don't take notes, that I'm not collaborative, that I don't see when other people look at it and go like, oh, it's slow here, or I'm confused here. Like, that's what you do when you make a movie, right? You're trying to make that story work. But that story has to come from a place that feels personal, and that worked for me on Dawn, and that created the opportunity on War, and I wanted to push it further, and I guess I had some capital by the fact that the film. And by the way, nobody knew that the film was going to be well received. There was a lot of talk about like, oh boy, prepare, this is not going to go well. And
really?
I was like,
they thought that was a dog?
Seriously.
The apes were a dog?
Some people thought the apes were a dog. Some people thought it was great. And nobody really knew how it was going to be received. And then it was received well, and it did really well. And then we were able to go forward. And the crazy thing on both these movies, because they're both studio films, they are the films, flaws and all, that I set out to make, which is an amazing thing because that was my biggest fear in getting involved with franchise filmmaking was, you know, this process you're talking about. And I see it. It puts the fear of God in me. I mean, I work from 9 in the morning till midnight every night because I want to make sure that I'm so inside the movie that when somebody comes in and casually says—
You mean executives?
Yeah, they look at it and they say, well, just do this and that. And I say, well, wait. So I would always take whatever their issues were, and instead of taking the prescriptive, I would say, look, I think there's an opportunity here to do something that I think needs to be done that answers your note. So you have to find a way to be really strong in your point of view, but also be able to work with them so that they understand that at least their concerns are being met.
But when you move from Cloverfield to Apes, let's say, I mean, the effects—
Monumentally harder.
I mean, what do you do? I mean,
I took a crash course. What I did was I asked Ryan Stafford, who was our VFX producer. I said, I don't understand this. All I know is I'm having an emotional response to a CG character that I've never had before. And I want to know why that is. I want you to show me every shot in this movie that was a VFX. And I want you to show me what it looked like as it was being shot on set. So I literally looked at side by side. Oh, here's Andy Serkis and here's Caesar. And the great thing was it was a huge relief. because I was like, there's no big trick here. It's a wonderful actor. He's incredible. And then you realize that the artists at Weta are incredible because what they're doing is they're taking a performance from this actor and they're translating it onto this photoreal ape so that you feel the same thing watching the ape that you felt watching the actor. And that's actually how we cut the movie. There's a version of the movie that doesn't have any apes in it. It's got Andy Serkis and the other performers. And that movie has to work before you start spending the tens of millions of dollars. I mean, this frame by frame, these effects are so incredibly expensive, it's ridiculous.
So you can't shoot that entire film with Andy and the others and then start CG, right? It has to go...
Well, on Dawn we couldn't. Because on Dawn, there wasn't the time. So that was horrifying.
Why was it so rushed?
Well, because they had a release date already and Rupert Wyatt had come in.
That's always very dangerous.
Yeah. We had that on War, but on War, I knew I had the full 3 years. On Dawn, what happened was the first year was Rupert Wyatt's and he had worked, you know, developing this script and they had come to Loggerheads. And for some reason, you know, I never saw that script. Each of these stories now has been entirely different in a certain way. But the through line of that character is the thing. When I came in on Dawn, I was like, you guys have earned this. Like, what people come away from with that movie is realizing that it's Caesar's movie. You can put your weight with that CG character. It's going to work. And in War, I wanted to push that even further because we kind of split the story. There was a parallel human and ape story in Dawn, and I wanted to make this story entirely from Caesar's point of view, which would really be one of the first times I think that anyone had leaned that heavily on the VFX to take the audience through an emotional experience.
I can't think of another.
Yeah, I don't think so, because it's, first of all, it's so incredibly expensive. Like, that character doesn't exist anywhere except as a performance by Andy Serkis until effects are done, and those effects are, I mean, there's like a village in Wellington where all of the artists are working.
This is Peter Jackson's company. Yes, I've been there.
Like it's like a town of artists, of incredible people. And so that's a lot of money, a lot of resources. I remember in the last movie, we used to time it by the second, and my shots tend to be slower. And so suddenly, oh, well, we thought that we could afford this shot, but this shot's like 10 seconds. It's not five and that kind of stuff. And that's a
that
process.
That makes a money difference.
Yeah. And so that was crazy.
So you were under the gun a bit on the first one, and you therefore had to do effects as you shot.
Yes. And then this one, we didn't start any effects until after I showed my director's cut. That was part of the thing we built into the schedule. They originally had said, you did it 2 years last time. Can we do it 2 years again? And I said, no.
No.
I said, we're going to do it right this time. And they let me do that. And so it was an incredibly intense post, but it was the right post. We had the right amount of time. We actually cut the movie. We put it together. We looked at it ourselves. Then we showed it to them. And then we began the process of turning over things we were confident in. What you do is you turn over the stuff you're feeling strongly about, and then you keep working on the rest. And as these shots start coming in, it's like you finally get the dailies. Finally, I have the shots of Caesar that we shot on the set that we never shot on the set, like that kind of thing. And that process is a constant sort of back and forth between doing effects, basically continuing to work the story and work the cut until literally the last day you deliver the movie. That's when the last effect goes in. That's the first time I really see the movie. It's weird.
So the motion capture of it all, did it change between one and two?
It didn't from impractical terms. I pushed us into snow and all these other conditions, but they proved they could do it on Dawn. So the conditions were harder, but the technique was exactly the same. What did get better was that Weta improved the pipeline that created the simulations for the hair, for the moisture on the skin, all of the things that exponentially suddenly the apes look much more real. And so we didn't think they were going to look that much more real, but they did. And that part of it's amazing.
So the visual of what it looks like when you're out there in the woods with Andy Serkis being Caesar, does he have a gazillion dots on his face?
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. He's out. It's not Planet of the Apes. It's Planet of the mocap dude and dudettes in their tight Lycra suits with dots on their faces and GoPro camera booms. They look bizarre. And that, by the way, is the movie that we're cutting for many months before we start the effects. And it works. Like, you actually look at it and you go, okay, it's not Planet of the Apes, but it's these weird guys. And I actually think it works because you're connecting to the emotion that is going to eventually be Caesar. So weirdly, it works. It sounds like it's a weird thing, but you forget about that in the first 5 minutes.
No, I'm just wondering if there's going to be a director's cut.
We have talked a lot about that. I would love to do that. I would love on the Blu-ray to release a version, if not scenes, which I would imagine we would do. It would be really interesting to show people what the movie looks like because it's crazy.
You know, on, as you well know, I'm sure, on Avatar, Jim Cameron fought hard for the performances.
Yeah, for sure.
They, you know, did side-by-side shots to try and convey. And I'm
sure that's what's going on, yeah.
And I'm sure that having seen the film, there would be a campaign for Andy Serkis.
Oh, for sure there will be. And, I mean, that side-by-side is what we do in our editing room. We have this connection to Weta, and we go up and half the day is spent editing, and the other half of the day, like, we have 10-hour sessions where we go shot by shot, and we look at Andy or the other actors, and next to that is Caesar and the proposed animation. And I'll say, you know, he looks really angry, Andy, and so does Caesar, but Andy's also a little sad here, and I don't see that yet in Caesar's face. So what do we do to draw out that emotion? And then we get into discussion with the animators. They say, well, that's because Andy, he's got, you know, his eyes have these fatty packets, and the way they look is very sad when he looks sad, but the anatomy on Caesar doesn't have that. And I was like, well, what can we do about that? And so they find a way to express that shape so that when you look at Caesar, you feel what you feel looking at Andy. And it's shot by shot for over a year. It's crazy. But when those two shots are seen by side by side, the effect of it is profound, because there's a version of the scene that looks exactly the same, except instead of an ape, it's Andy with dots on his face and this camera. And you're like, oh, that is so him.
So are you in New Zealand the entire time?
No. We're on the Fox lot, but we have a link, and we have a room that is like a dedicated screening room. And we go up there and we sit in the dark half of the day, and they're on a speakerphone, and they have a projector on our screen so that when we're using laser pointers to point, they can see literally what we're pointing at, and I can say, look, what's going on in his face here? And then they can respond, and we have this weird Skype session, essentially, that goes on for 10 hours a day.
So going back to the original question just briefly, if you're a young guy or woman,
yeah,
and you have made that movie, and they say, how would you like to do this?
Yeah.
Jurassic World, Marvel movie, whatever, what would you say to them?
Well, I would say, is the story something you can see yourself telling in a way that you're excited about? Because if it isn't, at least from my point of view, you're not going to do a good job. And then in practical terms, in terms of the education, I don't, that's a weird thing, because everybody has their own path, right? And I do feel like I had a specific path that prepared me for this, in that even though I'd done small movies, I started to get into some cutting edge effects, even within Cloverfield. Like, when we started out to do that movie, we made the trailer in a way to prove we could even make the movie, because we wanted to do handheld handycam effects. And they were like, well, you got to shoot that on Steadicam and add the shake later. And I was like, but that's never going to look real. And so we pushed the limits of what we could do there. That was my first sort of entree into it, even though it was small. So I had that experience that helped me. But I really do think all of that can be learned.
Right there with hundreds of people. I mean, that's the image I always get when I do these what went wrong stories.
Yeah.
Is this somebody standing there with 500 or I don't know how many hundred crew standing there waiting to shoot your scene.
It is. It is. It's over 100 people. It's like 200 people. It's
right.
Crazy. So you have to block all of that out. I mean, that's what a director's job is, right? But on these movies, especially, if you come from, I will say that it would be an especially hard transition, which I know is what they're doing now, because a lot of times you take somebody who's done something special that's small, and they say, hey, now you get to do our thing. And the idea is that somehow they're going to sprinkle a little bit of that specialness into their machine, right?
Yes.
And that never works. Like, you actually need that point of view that that person has. And part of it, you're right, it's a crash course. Anybody who had to do that, if they really wanted to do it, I would say you go in and you just begin educating yourself on how the heck these things are done. And that's really the biggest thing. If you have a point of view about what you want to do, and you engage with these people who are experts at what they do to say, how do we do this? Then that's an approach that would make sense for somebody who has not the experience in the effects world, but has a point of view about what they want to do.
Let them help you.
Yeah, for sure.
Coming up after a short break, filmmaker Matt Reeves talks about his next project, rebooting Batman. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to Matt Reeves, director of War for the Planet of the Apes, which is in theaters now. For his next movie, Reeves will take on another iconic franchise, Batman. The film was supposed to be directed by the most recent Batman, Ben Affleck, but he stepped away from the job and Warner Brothers turned to Reeves. So you are brought in, you're going to do, like, as I understand it, there's three Batman movies in your head.
Yes. Well, there's one Apes movie I'm just getting out of my head.
Right.
And there, I have a perspective about Batman that I'm excited about. And they have been excited about it too. So, you know, I've never worked with them. I have no idea, but...
Well, I wonder because, you know, and I know it's tricky to talk about your current employers, but they've had their woes and they finally managed to put one that was in a sweet spot. And
sure.
I don't know. Is that something that was discussed candidly where you said, look, you know, you've got to let me and do
mine?
Yeah,
I said, listen, if you want someone who's coming in from this perspective, because here's the thing, I'm also totally fine not doing Batman. It's not like I want to do any version of Batman. I want to do my version of Batman. And if that's exciting to them, which so far everything we've talked about is, then that's incredibly exciting because it means, wow, we're going to do something that we're all excited about. And if they're not, it's completely their prerogative, right? This is their franchise. They own the characters. They're going to spend a tremendous amount of money. So I'm not asking anybody to do what they don't want to do. All I'm saying is if we want to do the same thing, great. And if we don't, that's also okay. And so that's kind of how I started it.
You actually fell out for half a second.
I did. Yeah, I did. And I have to say that it's only just beginning. I mean, literally. But it's been really good. Look, I think they're really excited about what they've been able to do with Patty Jenkins on Wonder Woman and that they feel really good about a lot of stuff that they have. And they're really excited about the perspective that we've been talking about for this. And I am too, but it's really in its nascent stages. So who knows?
Well, I just find it striking and encouraging that you actually have in your mind three things that could happen with Batman.
Well, there are a lot of stories. And to me, it's really a perspective.
I mean, not that there's a limited number of stories in the world, but yeah. You have a vision for this.
Well, I have a vision for a way to do something with that character that at least feels like it resonates with me personally and a perspective that can grow outward into other things. But that is really about when they approached me, what they said was, look, it's a standalone. It's not like this isn't part of the extended universe.
They're not saying it's a trilogy either.
They're not saying that either.
Right.
They're saying this is not.
I'm saying that.
Yeah, you're saying that. I don't know how you knew that. But
wait a minute. Things out
yes,
sometimes.
Exactly. Look, I just, for me, I want to use the same approach that I've taken to everything, which is to find a personal way in, to do it from a point of view perspective, to make it emotional. I think there's a way to do a story about that character.
There absolutely
that is. Emotionally
is.
Engaging.
It's been done.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, you know, somewhat done here, somewhat, you know, bits
sure.
and pieces.
In pieces, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Or like, you know, I mean, like The Dark Knight, which I think is an incredible movie, the thing that really resonates about that is the Joker, like his story and that performance and everything about the filmmaking that relates to that character. It's his movie. And I think Christian Bale is great, but I think that that movie really resonated with everyone because of that character, its portrayal, and the way that the movie presented his unsettling perspective and the way that crashed up against Batman. I think what I'm interested in is being even more inside of Batman. I do see this weird parallel to Caesar in that here is a tortured soul who's trying to grapple within himself to find a way to do the right thing in a world that is corrupt, a world that is imperfect, and the stories would be about that struggle. The other thing is that to me what's exciting is that those stories, you know, especially as they started in like, you know, the Golden Age, they were like noir stories, right? They were very point of view driven. I think that there's a great possibility to do something that is from that noir point of view, intimate perspective filmmaking, which is my favorite kind of stuff.
I'll just say Michael Keaton, my favorite Batman.
He's great. I mean, Michael Keaton, I've loved him since Night Shift.
He's great.
He's incredible. Yeah, I love him. And what about Michelle Pfeiffer in Batman Returns? I think she's incredible in that movie.
I don't know if Catwoman is going to be part of your thing.
I'm just saying she was incredible.
You're just saying that. Okay.
I'm not going to say anything else.
We're going to get right now.
Yeah, okay.
Matt Reeves is the director of War for the Planet of the Apes. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can subscribe to The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.